一个。
Hi, everybody. Do you have a quick question before we start? Now might be a good time about the quiz, the DCF that's due next week. Laura, it's always been, I think you might be looking at the wrong syllabus. The syllabus for this class, it's always been next Monday. It's the other valuation class that it's April 6th, so it's always next Monday. You can check your calendar if you want for this class.
Hi, Professor. I'm just wondering, where do we submit our evaluation model? Do we give it to our TA or?
No. If you read the email, it says to email it to me with a specific subject matter in the email. So go back and review your email. It tells you.
Okay, thank you.
And Shu has a question about the solution to the quiz. The solution that's up there with the XLSX, so if you're using the old link, which is XLS, it must drop in 2016. But if you add the X at the end and make it the new version, you get the 2019 as well.
Professor, for the exam, since it's multiple choice, will working out count? Will we get some partial credit for it?
Or I can't even see it. The computer corrects it. That's the problem with multiple choice. It's zero or nothing. So it's five multiple choice questions. Hopefully you're not going to mess up in every one of them. So
if you have hopefully, yeah.
So basically if it's a math error, hopefully it'll be only one of the five. And that's why I doubled the time as well. Because I know I think it's more difficult doing multiple choice than open-ended questions because you can't show partial credit. So I made it, I've doubled the time and I've also I'm going to allow people to use their laptops. So you shouldn't have math errors because you'll have Excel open.
Yeah. Also, once you complete a question, can you go back to it? Or
yeah.
Once you do it?
Yeah. I've allowed for that option. Just, I mean, I'm going to give us, so I think we're all already there, so I'll start by talking about the quiz. So let's see how many people are in already. Okay. I'll give it a couple more minutes and then I'll talk a little bit about the structure for the quiz. Because given the time difference, I'm going to leave a fairly long window where you can where you can do the quiz, you know, anytime during that period. But once you open the quiz, you'll have only 1 hour. So, you know. And if you're one of those people who had were going to the Moses Center and you're getting extra time, I've created a separate version. You get an hour and a half. I made it 1.5, but if any of you have twice the time, I know a couple of you have 2 times, just let me know, because otherwise I'll just put the 1.5 as the default, but I can change it to twice the time if any of you get double the time. I think most of you, it's 50% more time if you're in the Moses Center, but just let me know. Okay, so I think whereas people join in, I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the quiz next Monday. The quiz is next Monday. It's going to be open for about, for many hours. I'm thinking about 7-8 hours. I leave it open, so I have to figure out starting and an ending time to reflect the fact that you're in different time zones. But once you open the quiz, it will be 1 hour from the time you open it. So make sure your broadband connection doesn't die within the hour, or you're on your cell service and your cell phone dies. Make sure that doesn't happen. You'll have exactly an hour. There are 5 multiple choice questions. Each is worth 2 points. And as I think one of the questions was, will you get partial credit? No, you will not get partial. The computer corrects. So I won't even get a chance to see whether you've done most of it right. This is one reason I don't like multiple choice questions, but unfortunately online, there is really no easy way to do this. So check your answers. You're allowed to have open book, open notes, open computer. You can even use your laptop. So you have much more leeway than you do in a typical quiz, and it's 1 full hour. So it'll cover everything we've done through the, so basically all the way through the loose ends, which means everything from cost of capital to cash flows to growth rate to all the loose ends, dealing with cash, dealing with cross holdings. So review all of that stuff for the quiz, because it's all fair game. Any questions about the quiz? Which, before we start, you can unmute yourself and ask a question if you want.
Professor, just want to clarify, it's only 5 multiple choice questions?
It's 5 multiple choice questions, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's get started. No other questions about the quiz? Is it cumulative? No, it's not cumulative. It's from, but let's face it, you know, if you don't know how to lever and unlever betas, which is part of the first quiz, well, you're going to have trouble in the second. It's not cumulative in terms of the material we cover, but if you really had trouble with the first quiz material, it's going to come back to haunt you on the second quiz. So I would suggest reviewing the parts of the first quiz material that are still giving you trouble, even though it's non-cumulative.
Hi, Professor. Will you post any past quizzes on NYU Classes?
I don't have to do that in NYU Classes. It's on the website. And you have multiple emails with links to this, right?
Okay, right. Thank you.
Professor, I have a question.
Yeah.
Will it still be similar to our past quizzes that we have access to?
Yeah. It's the same kind of structure. The only thing I've taken away is instead of you working all the way through, I've worked through the potential wrong solutions and the right solution and give you them as choices. That's really the only difference.
All right, thanks.
I wanted to ask another question, if you don't mind. Are there going to be any changes in the grading distributions or anything?
Well, are you asking me whether you can get a C or a D? I think that I won't enforce that 15% C's as long as you kind of pull your weight. But I'll be quite honest, if you don't do your project, then I'm going to leave open the option of giving out C's and D's. So if you are working through on the course and you're taking the quizzes and you're taking the project, don't worry about the grade. It'll take care of itself. But if you kind of abandon any parts of the project and leave them behind, if you refuse to take the quizzes and you don't turn in the project, I have no qualms about still giving Fs. The fact is, unless you have extenuating circumstances, you're a part of the world where you have no broadband, you can't do any of this stuff, I think that, you know, you should. I mean, I'm going to ask of you exactly what I'd have asked in the classroom. And I'm going to make things as easy as I can from a logistics standpoint for you to do stuff. But, That's really the only thing to keep in mind.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry, I missed it. Hi, Professor.
Yeah.
Sorry, I missed this. for clarification, will there just be one answer for the multiple choices, or
there's only one answer? Don't pick multiple. So basically, it'll allow you to have only one answer.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, folks. So let's go back and talk about where we left off last session. We were talking about valuing Amazon, and I talked about how I got the revenue growth now. And if you remember, it was almost reverse engineered, right? Because I visualized what I thought Amazon would look like as a mature company, then back from that into what the revenue growth would have to be for the next 10 years. So I thought Amazon is a successful company, at 40 billion revenues, the revenue growth rate got me there. For the margin, I looked at the typical margin for brick and mortar retail, and over time I pushed the margin up for Amazon to that number. So that's a heart of what I did, and it really drives the entire valuation. So are there any questions on this particular table? I'll take them now. Are there any questions on those two numbers? If you missed the last session, this is going to be completely mysterious. Try to catch up on that session. It's available on Zoom. I was able to figure out a way to download the stuff from Zoom and actually create a downloadable file and a YouTube file. So the class is up there for you to watch. So as you do, no questions? Okay. As you do this though, one of the things you want to be careful about is you have to remember that for most companies, scaling up is hard to do. And what does that even mean? Let's say you have a company, young company, it's growing at 80% in the most recent year. You're trying to sit down and project growth for the future. Remember, as you get larger, that growth rate is going to come down. It's going to come down pretty steeply for most companies. This is actually from a study that looked at companies that had just gone public. So these are these star growth companies. And what the study looked at was the growth rate at these companies relative to the growth rate of other companies in the sector in which went public. So you're comparing the growth rate of your IPO companies, your star companies, young companies, to the growth rate of more mature companies. So 1 year after the IPO, no surprise, your IPO companies have a growth rate 15% higher than the rest of the sector. You're saying, there, that's why I bought these companies. 2 years after, if you track these companies, their growth rate is only 7% higher. 3 years later, it's 3% higher. By the time I get to year five, your star growth companies look very much like the rest of the sector. What am I trying to show in this graph? That most companies' growth fades fast. So if you have a company where growth stays high for the next 10 years, you have to tell a story that justifies why your company is able to pull it off. That goes beyond, hey, last year my company grew very fast, so it will continue to grow. So as you look at your company and you make it bigger on your spreadsheet, you have to start to get more conservative about the growth rates you apply. And along the way, don't forget the lessons we talked about with reinvestment, which is to grow, you need to reinvest money. And with young companies, the only way to estimate reinvestment, let me emphasize this again, the only way to estimate reinvestment is to connect it to revenues. You can't use the reinvestment rate approach because your operating income will be negative. You can't use historical growth because you have no income to grow. You have to link your growth to revenues. And that's why I use the sales to capital ratio. So here's how it works. In the case of Amazon, I take the change in revenues from right now to next year, so 1.1 to 2.8 billion. I take that change in revenue of 1.676 billion, divide by 3, which is my sales to capital ratio for the sector. I get the reinvestment in year one. Then I do the same thing in year two. Take the change in revenues, divide by 3, reinvestment. Change in year. So each year, I'm taking the change in revenues, dividing by the sales to capital ratio, to get the reinvestment in that year. You say, what's in reinvestment? Everything, your acquisitions, your R&D. It's a consolidated number. And it's a number that essentially also becomes my change in invested capital from year to year. Let me explain. In the case of Amazon, my invested capital was 487 million when I started my valuation. Because I'm reinvesting 559 million in year one, my invested capital goes to 1,045. And every year I can keep track of my invested capital. You say, why bother? Because there's a simple test you can build into your spreadsheet to make sure you're not building fantasy companies. Because on a spreadsheet, you can get carried away. So here's what I do. I keep track of the invested capital I'm estimating for my company. I keep track of my after-tax operating income. And if I divide the after-tax operating income by the invested capital, I end up with a return on capital I'm assuming for my company based on my assumptions. So how do I use that? Take a look at Amazon. based on my assumptions about sales to capital and margins over time, my return on invested capital by the time I get to year 10 is a little over 20%. The question I had to ask myself was, am I comfortable giving Amazon 20% plus returns in capital in year 10? And in 2000, I felt okay with it. And here's why. The T-bond rate was 6.5%. The return on capital, even at retail firms, was 17 to 18%. So using a 21% return on capital did not seem to me to be an inconceivable number. So what you're trying to keep track of in this spreadsheet is, in addition to your investment assumption and your margin assumptions, are the numbers playing well together? If you look at the spreadsheet that I have, this I actually keep track of your return on capital over time. So take a look at what your return on capital becomes. One of the questions Stefano asked was, why is my sales to capital ratio constant over time? It doesn't have to be. That's part of your story as well. In this business, the retail business, I think it's very difficult to think about economies of scale. For instance, if you think there are going to be economies of scale when it comes to investment, you know what you can do? You can start with a sales capital ratio of 3, but it can become 4 in your last 5 years. So if in your story, you think your company is going to become more efficient about investing over time, you can change the sales to capital ratio. You can even build lags. You know what I mean by lags? If you think that if you invest in year 1, your growth is not going to show up to year 3, you can build that in as well. There's a lot of flexibility in the approach that you can use to kind of reflect your company. Any questions on this table and why I'm doing what I'm doing? So basically, all I'm doing in this table is making sure the assumptions I'm making about reinvestment and growth lead to a company that I can live with in steady state.
How would you show that lag in growth? Okay.
So what you'd have to do is remember how I took the change in revenues. Let's suppose you think there's a 2-year lag between when you reinvest and when you get growth. You would take the change in revenues from let's say year 3 to 4, that's 9 point, and divide by 3 and use that as your reinvestment in year 1. So basically all you'd have to do is take the change in revenues in year 3 and then use that to get your reinvestment in year 1. Change in revenues in year 4 and get the reinvestment in year 2. So essentially all that would mean is moving the change in revenues and your reinvestment apart by 2 years.
I see, thank you.
Why do you keep the sales and cap ratio constant throughout 10 years?
We just talked about this, right? Basically, sales to capital ratio state, it doesn't have to be. If you feel, for instance, that your company will become more efficient about investing in the future, that's part of your story. You can start at 3 for the first 5 years and then make it 4 or 5 in years 5, 6 through 10. If you think it's going to get less efficient, you can start at 3 and then move down to 2. If you remember my Tesla valuation, go back and review that Tesla valuation, because many of these things I do in that as well. For the first 5 years, I give them a high sales to capital ratio because they have excess capacity. They already have the Shanghai plant. And then after year 5, I move the sales to capital ratio down. So it doesn't have to be constant.
I see. Thank you.
Okay.
Professor, how did you get the initial 3 for sales and capital ratio?
Well, that's the sales to capital ratio for the sector. That's why I report sector averages for every sector on my website. And it's part of the spreadsheet as well, is I looked at the sector average for retail.
For example, like Amazon today, where it's a multi-business, how would you...
And you'd have to look at the sales to capital ratio for the entire market.
And like do the weighted average?
Well, it's already a weighted average, right? Sales to capital ratio for the market. If you're in many businesses and you have a different sales to capital ratio, you're saying, yeah, you'd have to do a weighted average. It's a pain in the neck, but there's really no way around it. Just like a beta. Any other questions?
Just a quick question out of personal curiosity. Did you buy more Tesla last week?
Not yet. I'm not that courageous. I think I'll wait. I bought a couple of stocks last week, but neither was called Tesla. You know why I haven't bought Tesla? The valuation that you see, so you're saying is my value 420 and it's now down to less than 420. Did I buy? That valuation was when? When was it done? End of January, right? You think the risk premiums have changed since then? The default spreads? Am I more worried about distress now than I did then? Absolutely. I'll have to revalue Tesla. I don't think the value is going to be 420 anymore. But I'll revalue it. I'm planning to do it in the next week. I'm going to revalue Tesla. My guess is my value's dropped If you ask me to guess or roughly, I would say around 300 right now is my value. So it's a moving target at the moment. If it continues to drop, then I think I'll buy it. But no, I'm not buying it just because. And be very careful. If you have a valuation you did pre-crisis, don't compare the price today to that valuation because you're comparing apples to oranges. Any other questions? Okay, so Julie, go ahead.
In your Excel spreadsheet of valuing Amazon, the depreciation, you times the revenue growth rate, you times is like 3 years lag, if I remember correctly. So there's a lag of the rate when you compute the depreciation.
Not in Amazon, definitely not the case.
Okay.
I don't think I put a spreadsheet up with a lag. Most of the companies I've been valuing have been tech companies. There should be no lag. It's manufacturing and infrastructure companies where you get a big lag.
Okay.
So one of the things you will notice in this valuation, if you look at my free cash flow to the firm, my free cash flow to the firm are negative. I don't see it in this graph, but my free cash flow to the firm are negative for the first 6 years. Remember that for Amazon, year one, year two, year three, billion dollars. And when you have negative free cash flow to the firm, because I assume that most of it would come from equity, you know that Amazon is going to be issuing shares next year, 2 years out, 3 years out. And when you issue shares, your share count will increase, right? So one of the questions people often have when they value young companies is you've done a discounted cash flow valuation. Should you use today's share count or the share count that you think will exist after you've counted the new shares you have to issue? You know what? I'm going to give you some really good news and then explain why this is good news. You don't have to count the extra shares that will be issued in the future. And here's why. It's already incorporated in your DCF. And here's how it's incorporated. If you look at my Amazon valuation, I get $14.9 billion as my present value. That present value is affected by my negative cash flows in the first 6 years, right? The present value of those negative cash flows is pushing down my value today by about 25%. That is already the dilution effect reflected in my present value. Because I've counted it through my cash flows, I don't have to adjust my share count. In fact, if I increase my share count as well, I'll be double counting. So I know it sounds mysterious, and I'll send you a link with your post that explains this with using an actual company. But the share count, you can just reflect today's share count, even though you have a young company that's going to have negative cash flows in the future. The present value already incorporates a dilution. Now, if you're worried about failure, and you should be for young companies, and you know, this graph actually shows you, it's actually a graph from the Department of Labor, which keeps a very interesting data set on companies, startups, and what percentage of companies that get started up last 1 year, that's a green column, 2 years, it's a purple. You know? So by sector, you can see for every 100 companies, 100 natural resource companies that get started, only 82% make it through year one, and only about 36% make it through year 10. So we have young companies, a lot of young companies don't make it. In fact, collectively across all companies in the market, about 70% of all startups don't make it to year 10. So let's say you're valuing a startup. You do a discounted cash flow valuation using all the techniques we've talked about. Use revenue growth and a target margin and a sales to capital ratio. You come up with the present value, you value per share. That value per share reflects the value for this company if it makes it through 10 years to nirvana. You know what nirvana here is, right? The terminal value. But what if it doesn't make it? There is no way in a discounted cash flow valuation to reflect it. The best way to actually see this, and you can actually see the drop off. This is actually a more detailed graph of what percentage of companies actually make it. And these are young companies. I'm not talking about traditional public companies. These are young startups. As you look across time, there are actually variations across sectors, and you can see what percentage don't make it. The best way to bring it in is to bring it in after your valuation by asking, what is the chance my company will not make it? If you remember a couple of sessions ago when I valued Uber using the story, I valued Uber as a going concern, and I came up with about 6.6 billion. Then I said, there's a 10% chance Uber will not make it. You know what my equity is worth under that 10%? It's worth nothing. My expected value for Uber will then be 90% times 6.6 billion plus 10% times zero, which is why my value for Uber is only 6 billion. I'm actually evaluating Boeing right now. I'll send you, that'll be your evaluation of the week next week. And we'll have updated equity risk premiums and what we've learned about the crisis. And I do a traditional discounted cash flow valuation of Boeing, and I come up with the value per share. But let's face it, Boeing right now is under threat. It's under threat because it has $28 billion in debt outstanding, and there's a very real risk that it will not be able to make those debt payments. Not as big as some people think it is. It's not like an airline. It's not a basket case company. But when I value Boeing and I come up with a DCF value, I've got to reflect the fact that there is a chance now, and it's not tiny, that this company will not make it. Then I'm going to ask a follow-up question. If Boeing has trouble making it through these debt payments, if it requires an immense bailout from the U.S. government, in return for the bailout, the U.S. government demands the equity be written to zero, which is what it did in 2009 for GM, then my equity is worth nothing. I have to bring in that failure risk. So when you look at that Boeing valuation, you're going to see me try to incorporate failure. But it's a good idea, after you've done with the DCF, to ask, what is the chance my company will not make it? Any questions about failure and how to deal with it? It is going to be subjective. So don't sit there beating yourself up saying, well, how do I know whether it's 10 or 15%? Just ask yourself, is it going to be high or low? And then make up a number and move on, because it is an estimate you're making, and nobody out there has a much better way of doing it. Maybe if you have a bond rating, Boeing's bond rating is dropped to BBB this week. You know what, the 10% of BBB rated companies over the next 10 years default. So you can say, given that BBB rating and given what S&P thinks, I think there's a 10% chance they will not make. So that's one thing to think about, is one way to estimate that probability that your company will not make. So let's wrap up here. So I came up with the value of $35 per share for Amazon. The stock was trading at 84. And I get ready to finish my, remember, it was an online webcast. So I was doing my webcast. I'm getting ready to finish. And one of the participants asked a question. It's a very plaintive question, perhaps because she owns shares in Amazon. She said, is it possible that Amazon is worth $84 per share? My response was, possible is such a weak word. Of course it's possible. In fact, all I need to get to 84 is I need much higher revenue growth. So that's what's on that, the top axis there. Remember, I used revenue growth, y-axis here. Remember, I used revenue growth of 42%. Maybe the revenue growth is going to be 55 or 60 or 50%. Or maybe it has much higher margins. A combination of higher revenue growth and higher margins will allow me to get to $84. So what I did was I looked for break-even points. So it's not rocket science. I sat there trying different growth rates and different margins. These shaded areas are all numbers greater than $84. So for Amazon in 2000 to be worth more than $84 per share, they would need a revenue growth rate of 60% and margins of 8%, or revenue growth of 55% and margins of 10%. And you can basically see the break-even points and then ask yourself, would I buy Boeing given these break-even points? It's just a different way of framing whether you'd invest in a company. So look for those break-even points and see how much buffer you have. So it's a good way to ask the final follow-up question on your valuation. So after I was all done, you know, this was the very last question, and somebody asked, you know, aren't you worried you're going to be wrong? And I said, of course I'm going to be wrong. I'm going to be wrong 100% of the time. In fact, I've never, ever done a valuation where I've been 100% right. You know what I mean by that? You do a valuation, you project out cash flows, and then year after year, the numbers come in exactly as predicted. If that happened, I'd freak out. You know, there'd be some Twilight Zone episode going on. You're always going to be wrong. With young companies, you're going to be horribly wrong. But remember, you don't have to be right to make money. You just have to be less wrong than everybody else. Remind yourself of it. It's a hugely comforting feeling, because all you can do is make your best estimates. You're in the dark, just like everybody else. So I know many of you are saying this. Corona crisis has made my life difficult. Hey, guess what? It's not just your life. Everybody's facing these uncertainties. Make your best estimates, accept you'll be wrong, and come back and revisit the numbers if you're wrong, because that's all you can do. And just to illustrate how this plays out, the valuation I did of Amazon in 2000, I got a $34 value. The stock was trading at 84. I thought it was overvalued. 1 year later, I revisited Amazon and I valued it again. And during that year, of course, the dot-com boom bust, the economy went into recession. My value went from 34 to 21. You think that's terrible. Your value changed so much. Look at what happened to the stock price. It went from 84 down to level. And in 2001, I was trapped. Trapped in what sense? Somebody, it was another webcast I did for the CFA, and somebody in the webcast asked, would you buy the stock? And I had to stay consistent and say, yes, I'm buying. I bought Amazon for the first time in my life in 2001. In 2002, I revalued Amazon. You can't just sit on the original valuation because things change. My value went up, price also went up, but I held on. 2003, I revalued Amazon. The value almost doubled. You're saying this is great, but the price almost tripled. So guess what I had to do in 2003? I sold the shares. But it's not forever. 2006, I bought it again. I bought Amazon four times and I've sold Amazon four times in the last 20 years. And it's based on the fact that every year I value this company and I look at the stock price. So whatever company you're valuing, even though you might not pull the trigger right now on buying or selling the company, come back and revisit that company. It might be undervalued, overvalued today. It could become undervalued a year from now. Valuation is a dynamic, ongoing process. And this is something you're going to be playing. This is a game you're going to be playing pretty much for the rest of your investing life on a company. Any questions on the Amazon valuation or anything we've done over here? Yeah. One final wrap up before we finish off Amazon. I almost never do this because it's an exercise which is very humbling, but it's actually worth doing. Remember the 2000 valuation, I forecast numbers for Amazon for the next 10 years. In 2014, I actually went and looked at the actual numbers to see how close I got to the actual. So let's say 2001, my forecast was 5.6 billion. They came in well under because that was the year the dot-com boom bust. By 2010, I was predicting 41.3 billion. They were at 34 billion. 2011, they got slightly ahead. My operating income, I projected 43.83. They came in well below. So if you look at what Amazon actually did, they grew much faster than I thought they would, especially if you go all the way through 2014. Their margins didn't improve as much as I thought they would. So one of the reasons you see me revisit valuations is the actual numbers come in, you get a chance to look at your original story and say, did I get something wrong? And redo your valuation. And in 2018, I valued them, September of 2018, this was my updated story for Amazon. Now in 2000, I valued them as an online retail company. By 2018, I changed my mind. In 2018, I valued Amazon as a disruption machine. And this is something I talked about, which allows them much higher potential for growth because they're no longer constrained to be just a retail company. So if you look at my projected revenues for Amazon in 10 years, this is based on 2013, I'm giving them revenues of 626 billion, which would make them the largest revenue company in history. No company in history has ever had revenues. I think Walmart is the highest revenue so far. It's about $500 billion. I'm giving revenues of 626 billion. The reason I can get away with it is they're going to be in everything. I am going to assume that over time, their margins are going to improve, that they will use their pricing power and strength to do it. The only constraint I see on Amazon is regulatory pushback from governments and monopoly power, you know, monopoly laws. But based on the story, which is an incredibly optimistic story, the value per share that I got in September of 2018 for Amazon was $1,255 per share. The stock was actually trading at $1,970. The stock was back to being overvalued, but I asked a follow-up question. Okay? Remember, each of the assumptions I made for Amazon, I'm uncertain about. I'm uncertain about the revenue growth. I'm uncertain about the margin. I'm pretty much uncertain about everything. In a Monte Carlo simulation, I can basically ask basically make every input into a distribution. So rather than treat the revenue growth rate as a single number, I made it a distribution where my expected number was still 15%, but it could be as low as 5 if I've screwed up it's more pessimistic, or 25. So my base number, my expected value is not changing, but I'm putting a distribution. My operating margin stays 12.5%, but I made it a distribution, a normal distribution with standard deviation of 2%. My sales to invested capital, my expected value is 5.95, but there again, I've given a wide range. And my cost of capital, my expected value is 7.97%. But basically, I put it into distribution where I could potentially have much higher cost of capital. When a Monte Carlo simulation, what happens is you run each time, you pick a number out of each distribution and you get a value. Each time you run a simulation, you get a different value. My median value for Amazon across 100,000 simulations is about $1,241. Very close to my base case valuation of $1,255, but that shouldn't surprise you. I'm using the same base case assumptions. But here's the additional information I get. Remember, the stock was trading at about $1,900. If you ask me, is it possible Amazon is worth $1,900? I have to say yes, because look at the tail of the distribution. It's around the 85th percentile. Would I buy at 1,950? No, I wouldn't buy it. But it tells me at least where I fall in the distribution. Okay? So here's what I did. I actually sold short on Amazon. For the first time in my investing life, I sold short. It's a terrifying stock to sell short on in September of 2018. And at the moment that I sold short, I also put in a limit cover. You know what a limit cover is? When you sell short, you buy shares to cover your short sale. I put it in a limit cover and said, if the stock price drops to 1,411, which was my 60th percentile, I said, sell the shares. And I got incredibly lucky. In the next 4 months, Amazon went into free fall. It fell as low as 1,320, but when it dropped to 1,411, my short sale covered, but I made almost $550 per share on the short sale. I'm not saying every story I'm going to tell is going to have a happy ending, but by having the distribution, it tells me not only when I should buy, but also when I should sell. It's actually a good way to think about adding more information to your decision process. Any questions about any of the things we did on Amazon in this in these last few pages? Now, the way I did this simulation is I used a program called Crystal Ball. Stern actually has that available. It's an add-on to Excel. So you can download Crystal Ball and add it onto Excel. It adds an extra menu. It allows you to take any valuation you've done, including the valuation of the company you're going to be doing, and convert it into a Monte Carlo simulation. One of the things you'll have to learn to use Crystal Ball is about distributions, which is not difficult. It's not a difficult thing to do. But it's something worth thinking about, especially if you want to make evaluations richer.
Professor, for your standard deviation as well as the high and low, how did you calculate that?
Well, you can look, for instance, if you look at operating margins, I'm looking at across retail firms, right? And if you look at 150 retail firms, some have margins of minus 3%, some might have 18%. So I'm actually using my cross. So rather than just use the average margin for a retail firm or whatever the firm is, or whatever the sector you're looking at, I'm looking at the entire distribution and trying to gauge from that distribution, what's the range, what's high, what's low, what does the distribution look like? So when you think about creating these distributions, they're either going to look at historical data for some variables, cross-sectional data, cross companies for others, or data from your own company over time. Amazon's been around 22 years. I can see what their margins look like every year, what their sales to capital ratios look like every year. Ultimately, though, you have to make a judgment call. But those are the three places you can go to get the information to make those assessments. Well, the types of distributions you pick will have to depend on the variables. Some variables are left skewed and right. You know what? I'll send you a little paper I wrote for to kind of as a guide to how do you decide whether you pick a normal or a log normal. So it's about 12 pages. It's not a deep paper, but if you get a chance after the session, I will send it out. Read it. Maybe you might want to do it after your quiz, but it's actually a good kind of review of how do you pick a distribution for a particular data. Any other questions? Okay. So let's keep moving to the next aspect of the dog set. Now I want to talk about mature companies. Normally when you value mature companies, you feel pretty comfortable. Why? Because they have a long history, they have a business model. So you're saying, look, I know Kraft Heinz, I know what they do. So you feel pretty comfortable, except when what they've been doing stops working. And a lot of companies, this has become the case. Why does it stop working? The business matures, disruption comes in, and these companies continue to do what they did. And what happens with this disruption is these companies sometimes are forced to change. They're forced to change by whom? By activist investors. A Carl Icahn or a Bill Ackman gets on and says, you've got to change the way you do things. even though it used to work 20 years ago, it's no longer working. So the challenge you face with these companies is you can't just take the historical numbers and make them the numbers for the future, because that's not what the company is doing anymore. So I'll give you an example. I'll give you exactly what I'm talking about using that those four questions that I frame my valuations around. Remember the four questions you try to answer when you value a company? What are your cash flows from existing investments? What is the value added by future growth? How risky are your cash flows? When will your company become a mature company? With mature companies in transition that are changing, you get two answers to every single one of these questions. If the company continues to do what it's doing, let's call it status quo, you get one answer. And if the company changes to reflect the changing times, you get a different answer. Let me explain what I mean. Let's say the company's history is to reinvest 30% of its after-tax operating. Its reinvestment rate is 30%, and it makes a 10% cost of capital. So you say, my reinvestment rate is 30%, I'm making a 10% cost of capital. This is easy. 30% of 10% gives me a growth rate of 3%. That's a status quo. But let's say the business has changed, and this company should really be reinvesting only 10%, not 30%. So the reinvestment rate should be much lower. And if it did that, it could have a much higher return on capital. Then, when you look at the company, with the restructuring, you'll have a 10% reinvestment rate and a 20% return on capital. So with every question, you have two different answers depending on whether the company continues to do what it does or whether it changes to reflect the changing terms. I know it sounds incredibly abstract, but let me give you an example. It's a company called Hormel Foods. It's been around a long time, almost 100 years. You know what its most famous product is? One of the most disgusting things I've ever eaten. Does anybody know?
Chili.
What does Hormel Foods make?
Hormel chili.
Hormel chili is not disgusting. I like Hormel chili. They have an even more famous product. Product that only they make.
Spam.
Spam, exactly. Have you ever eaten Spam? Anybody eaten Spam? Don't eat it. Spam is meat that comes in a can with a shelf life of 2 nuclear wars. Don't even ask me how you put meat in a can and it can last 200 years, but Spam can last forever. In fact, the history of Spam is actually interesting. Spam was concocted or made by Hormel Foods at the end of the Second World War. Because here's what happened. At the end of the Second World War, the U.S. Army was trying to get its soldiers back from Asia, back to the U.S. And that was too long a trip to make on military planes. So what happened was they would stop in Hawaii, which is pretty much halfway between Asia and the U.S. And so you had tens of thousands of hungry soldiers landing in Hawaii. And this is Hawaii circa 1945. There was nothing there, no food. So the U.S. Army put out a requisition. They said, these are hungry soldiers, and they're not vegan. They want meat. We want some company to come up with a way of getting meat to Hawaii, but we have no refrigeration, so we can't store the meat. We want meat that can be kept in cans. And Hormel invented Spam. That's why if you go to Hawaii still, you can get cookbooks that are based on Spam, like 100 different ways you can make Spam, stir-fry Spam, Spam casserole. It's disgusting no matter how you make it. But that's the product. That long backstory, Hormel's been around a long time. It's had a glorious past, but it's now kind of a mature food processing company. And it's run by managers who are stuck in the past. They're still running Hormel as if it's 1970. So their growth is entirely in the U.S. They don't even think the rest of the world exists. So here's what I did. I first valued Hormel Foods, assuming that the existing management stays in place. And what's the existing management doing? They're not reinvesting much. They have a low growth rate. They don't use much debt. Why? Because that's what they've always done. The value per share that I get for Hormel with those assumptions, assuming the existing status quo, is $31.91. But Hormel has a potential for change, especially if they look global. There is a potential they can reinvest more. And if they reinvest more, they might have to settle for a lower return on capital, but they'd have a higher growth rate. So this is my second valuation of Hormel with new and different management, higher growth, a little bit more debt in their cost of capital. And what I get as my value per share is about $38. So I have two different values for Hormel, $32 with the status quo, $38 with somebody else running the company, saying, how the heck am I going to use this? If you can attach probabilities that to the fact or to the status quo and the likelihood of change, you can get an expected value across those two scenarios, right? Because as an investor, you don't know which one's going to hold. At the time that I did this valuation, I gave a 90% chance that the status quo would prevail. And here's why. Hormel's largest stockholder is the Hormel Foundation. The Hormel Foundation has about 36% of Hormel, and it's really the old Hormel family that used to own the company's shares. It's run by a board, none of whom are Hormels anymore, but there's a board of directors. So I took a look at the board of directors of Hormel Foundation to see whether they put some pressure on Hormel to change. And guess who chairs the Hormel Foundation board? It's the CEO of Hormel. And my stomach dropped. I said, there's no chance, or very little chance, of pressure coming in Hormel. That's why I've attached a 90% chance. But I'll tell you what could change this. If tomorrow I read a news story that Carl Icahn has taken a 7% position in Hormel, hey, Carl's a pushy guy. That 10% chance of change might become 21%. You saw this actually play out in the last 2 weeks with Occidental, where Carl Icahn has actually taken a larger position to push for change. Occidental actually very quickly conceded and made those changes. But with mature companies, that's something to think about, is you can value the company with the status quo. That's easy to do. But if your company is facing change, you might have to do a second valuation. You say, if something changed in the company, what would the value be? And take expected values. So that's a big deal. But with mature companies, there are some qualifiers I'm going to add, lessons I've learned in many mature companies. First is many mature companies, especially when they're restructuring, talk about cutting costs. And they give you these plans. We're going to cut costs by $2 billion, $3 billion, $3.5 billion. But many of them are unable to carry this through. So they announce in the Wall Street Journal they're going to cut costs by $3 billion. But 3 years later, you look at these companies, they cut costs by $1 billion or $0.5 billion. So one of the areas of research I've kept track on is these McKinsey studies on what kinds of companies actually carry through on their promise when it comes to cost cutting, what characterizes these companies. So again, don't read too much into this. It's a subjective study, but basically looked at what characterizes companies where they promise cost cuts and actually deliver. And the most critical factor was, is the top management completely behind this? Or is this something being thrust on them? Are they clear targets? Are they giving you actual numbers? Are they just saying we cut billions of dollars but not specifying how many billions? Is there a clear plan up front on cutting the cost? Do they have the capabilities to cut the cost? So essentially, when you see a company, and maybe this is a company you're valuing saying we're going to cut costs, maybe you want to look past the press releases to see if, in fact, they're the kinds of companies that will carry it through. Now, the second thing to remember is, you know, many of these companies also talk about going back to growth, but going back to growth is not that easy. And if you think about, you know, earning more than your cost of capital, a lot of companies have a really difficult time earning more than their cost of capital. And if you're in a bad business, growth can actually destroy value. And our parameter for value creation or value destruction is whether you can earn more than your cost of capital. So here's the bottom line. If you're in a business where the returns on capital are less than the cost of capital and you're in trouble, the answer to your troubles is not growing more, but actually shrinking. So when you think about increasing growth, it might seem like a good option, but before you go down that road, again, check your company. Is it the kind of company where the return on capital is higher than the cost of capital? Look at your company, look at the sector. And if it's the kind of company where return on capital is greater than the cost of capital, maybe you can map out a growth plan. But if it's in a business that's a bad business, maybe the best thing they can do is hold back on growth, become less ambitious, not more ambitious, because that'll make them more valuable as a company. And finally, on the cost of capital. Remember for Hormel, I increased their debt ratio because I said these managers are not as conservative. You're saying, why do you pick 40%? No, why not 10%? Why not 80%? Why not 70%? I teach two classes, you know, I teach a corporate finance class before I teach a valuation class, and for my MBAs, many of them take both classes. My online version of my corporate finance class is actually on my website if you want to watch a few of the sessions. And one of the things we talk about in corporate finance is an optimal debt ratio. What's the right mix of debt and equity for my company? It's actually not rocket science. Here's what I do. I take the debt ratios. I go from 0 to 90%. This is Hormel. Remember, as my debt ratio goes up, my beta will go up. Why? Because it's a levered beta. And as my debt ratio goes up, my cost of equity goes up. And as my debt ratio goes up, my bond rating will go down. Why? Because my interest expenses will climb, my coverage ratios will decrease. So these are my synthetic ratings. So what I'm doing here is actually computing what my cost of equity and my cost of debt will be at every debt ratio. You're saying, how's that going to help me? Remember, the weighted average of your cost of equity and the cost of debt is your cost of capital. So you look at this column, you see my cost of capital Hormel over time. And you can see that initially, at least, raising debt lowers my cost of capital. Right now, they're at a 10.39% debt ratio. Their cost of capital is 6.79%. If they keep borrowing money, their debt ratio, their cost of capital keeps going down. But once you get to between 30 and 40%, it levels up and then it starts to go up again. That's why I stopped at a 40% debt ratio. If it had continued to decrease until 70%, I'd be more inclined to go to 70%. So there is no rule of thumb here. You have to kind of get a sense of what the right debt ratio is for your company. Don't just arbitrarily raise the debt ratio for your company saying, look, my cost of capital went down, because that might not be realistic and might actually get your company into trouble. So to do this right, you actually estimate the cost of capital at different debt ratios. But if you don't have the time to do that in your valuation, at least look at the typical debt ratios of the sector. So if you're in a sector where everybody else has 30% debt ratios and you're at 6% and you have the capacity to borrow more money, at least move your debt ratio to 30% and see what happens to your valuation. So mature companies, again, reviewing. Most of the time, you have lots of data, you have a lot of history, and you're going to be tempted to just take that data and history and just project out into the future. But remember, if your company is facing change, and some of them will change, that valuation is not going to be a realistic valuation. You've got to ask a follow-up question. What can I change in this company? It's really an exercise in restructuring, and you've got to value the company with the restructuring and come up with a different value. Even if you're not comfortable attaching properties, show me both values, status quo value, optimal value, need be. And if you're doing things right, your optimal value should be higher than your status quo value. It's a very useful analysis to do, because later when we talk about acquisitions and control premiums, this is the process we're going to use to estimate the value of control. So I'm going to pause for a couple of minutes and open up to any questions you might have about valuing mature companies. For some of you are valuing mature companies, you're going to be tempted with the historical data to just you do financial modeling, project numbers out. And my advice is please be careful, because that's going to kind of create some issues for you if your company is facing change.
Professor
Pablo, go ahead.
One thing I didn't understand was, can you explain again why sometimes growth might be detrimental for a mature company?
Well, for growth to create value, what has to be true?
They need to...
Your return on capital has to be greater than your cost of capital, right?
Yeah.
Remember, when we did growth, that was the key. It was good growth, bad growth, average growth. So if you're in a business like the automobile business, where the returns on capital, the entire business, have dropped below the cost of capital. When Volkswagen asks, how quickly should I grow? My answer is, maybe you shouldn't grow. Maybe you should shrink as a company. So that's really the driver, is look at what kinds of returns on capital you see in that business. And if the returns on capital in a business have dropped below the cost of capital, it's a bad business. Growing in a bad business will only destroy that.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have one question. Yep. So back in my corporate finance class, our professor taught us that like the capital structure and like the how much like value you get out of having more debt comes purely from the having the debt shield, and like you cannot really estimate the perfect cost structure, because
I won't name names, but he was absolutely wrong.
Okay, because he said like there's a direct cost and the indirect cost, and the indirect cost is not estimable, so you cannot really estimate the perfect
cost structure. That's a cop out. That's a complete cop out. So go watch my sessions on capital structure. You know, I'm not picking on your professor. Maybe I am. You know, but that's absolute nonsense.
Okay, thank you.
It's difficult to do, but everything in life is difficult. Doesn't mean you can't do it. And this approach doesn't require indirect or indirect. Maybe he was using that APV approach, which is another crapshoot that was invented at the University of Chicago. I don't need an indirect bankruptcy cost. All I'm looking at is a cost of capital. Right? So go back and look at those sessions if you want. You can go, if you go to my website and click on teaching and you go to the corporate finance class, check the spring 2019 class, because for the 2020 class, I haven't got to capital structure yet. And watch the sessions on capital structure. It's one or two sessions. That's all you need to watch.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so let's talk about the most depressing valuations of all. And unfortunately for many of you, this might be the scenario you face. You picked a company that you thought was healthy 6 weeks ago. And that is when you're dealing with a company which, looking forward, is looking at decline and perhaps distress. Again, let's see why this is difficult to do. Let's say you're dealing with a company, let's give it a name, JCPenney. I hope none of you picked JCPenney or Bed Bath & Beyond, but if you did, I'm going to ask you, what are your cash flows and existing assets? And you show me your history. You know what your history is going to look like? Shrinking revenues, margins dropping over time, depressing. Then I ask you, what's the value of growth? You start laughing. What value for growth? You're basically losing value. You're thinking about shrinking, not growing. And as you shrink, your risk itself could change. Your cost of capital could be changing, depending on whether you pay down debt or you don't pay down debt. So essentially, every question, you're going to see yourself faced with numbers you don't see with healthy companies. Cash flows are decreasing, your revenues are shrinking, your margins are getting worse, growth is destroying value, and your business risk is evolving. And hanging over all of this is the reality that your company might not make. You're faced with a depressing valuation, right? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start first talking about why value declining companies gives us trouble, then bring in distress after the fact. So if I give you a company in a shrinking business, let's take Bed Bath & Beyond. Bed Bath & Beyond is going nowhere. There's no growth left in its future. The question is, can it manage its shrinkage? You have to be willing to use a negative growth rate. You know what I mean by that? When I ask you, what's your growth rate for the next 5 years in revenues? Your expected growth rate might have to be minus 5%. The reason we're so uncomfortable doing this is human beings are hardwired to be optimistic. So when I ask you to put a negative growth rate, part of you says, no, that can't happen. But it does happen. It can happen. So with declining companies, the first thing you've got to get over is the fact that your revenue growth could be negative for the near future. And your margins can actually be shrinking. If your most optimistic scenario is you can shrink your way to becoming a sustainable, much smaller company, that's what your end game will be. But in some cases, that might not even be feasible. You're going to have to shrink and eventually liquidate. So rather than having a terminal value, you might have to have a liquidation value. So here's the difference. Healthy company, you have positive revenue growth, improving margins, big terminal value. Declining companies, you have negative revenue growth, your revenues are shrinking, your margins are coming down, and your end number is not a terminal value, but a liquidation value, which is going to be a fraction of a terminal value. Your worst case scenario when you have a declining company is managers running the company are in denial. You know what I mean by in denial? They don't realize they're a declining company, declining business. They act like they're middle-aged or young companies. They want to grow. They want to take investments. And that could be devastating for you as an investor because they're growing in bad businesses. They're taking your money and investing in more and more. When Marissa Mayer was made CEO of Yahoo, Yahoo, by the time Marissa Mayer became CEO, was already in, forget about old, it was on its, it was a walking dead company. On its, but what did Marissa Mayer do for the first 3 years? She bought Tumblr, she did this, she spent $4.5 to $5 billion before finally one day she woke up and said, sorry guys, this company can't be rescued. The $5 billion it spent is gone. So when you have managers that refuse to face the facts, it can cost you. And when you're doing valuation, that's what you worry about. Are my managers realistic enough to stop investing because the business is bad? Or they can keep trying and keep trying, and in the process cost me more money? So that's the first thing. So let's do an example here with JCPenney. Okay, so this is a valuation I did in 2016. And in hindsight, this is probably an optimistic valuation. So here's what they had. They had revenues of $12.5 billion and margins of 1.3%. But the typical margins historically used to be about 8 to 9%. So I sat down to value JCPenney and I thought about, is there any potential for growth? And I remember the last time I went to a JCPenney, I left very quickly saying, I don't want to be in this store. There's nobody here. The cash registers are closed. The inventory is dead. So I put in a negative growth rate. Essentially, so JCPenney has lots of stores. It has mall stores, it has city stores, it has big stores, it has small stores. So here's what I'm doing. I'm shutting stores down. And I'm shutting my worst stores down. And I'm hoping that as I'm shutting my worst stores down, the stores I'm left with have higher margins. So what you're seeing me map out over time is a shrinking company. My revenues decrease over time. And as I shut down my worst stores, my margins improve, not to what they were before Amazon came along in the late 90s, but to about two-thirds of the way. So essentially, my story is a depressing one, a shrinking company with steady state margins that are going to be pretty low. And I come up with a value per share of about 4.8 billion. But there is a real chance that JCPenney doesn't make it. So I put a 20% chance of failure. And this is what I meant about bringing in the failure risk separately. And when I bring in the 20% failure risk, the value that I get for the operating assets drops even more to about 4.4 billion. This is a valuation that is a depressing valuation because your revenue shrinks, but it's realistic given the kind of company you're at. So that's a declining company. I wasn't worried about distress for JCPenney as much in 2016, but the more you worry about distress, the greater this probability of failure is going to become and your adjusted value will reflect. So if you have a declining company where you're just worried about distress in the long term, this is the best way to deal with it. Okay? Now let's talk about valuing a declining company where distress could happen anytime soon. This is actually the worry you have with the coronavirus. Is a lot of companies that were teetering on the edge could now get pushed over. Here, you actually have to be explicit about estimating the probability of failure very quickly. Because your value of equity will be your DCF value. And remember, your DCF value assumes your company makes it as a going concern, times the probability that you will survive, plus whatever you will get as an equity investor in liquidation if the company is pushed into default. So when you think about an airline, especially the smaller airlines, Spirit Airlines, for instance, where you think, look, the company might not make it, you'll have to adopt this approach. In fact, 80% of the airlines around the world, I think you have to do this. So you have to estimate a probability of default. You think, how the heck am I going to do that? The first is to use a bond rating for a company. And I'll give you a very simple way you can convert bond ratings into default spreads based on history. And I'll give you an example. If you're a BBB rated airline, your probability of default is going to be about 9 to 10% because that's a history of the percentage of BBB rated company bonds that default. If you're a single B rated airline, your probability of defaulting probably went up to 20 or 21%. If you're a CCC rated airline, there's a 40 to 50% chance you will not make. So if you're rated, I can use the rating to come up with the probability. The second is a statistical approach. It requires a lot of data and it requires that you get comfortable with an approach called probits. It looks like a regression, but it uses statistics and data to estimate a probability of default based on companies that have defaulted before. That's a tough one to pull off because it requires access to data and statistical skill. The third is a trick, where if your company has bonds that are traded, you can reuse the traded bond price to back out a probability of default. You say, what are you talking about? I'm going to give you an example in a couple of minutes, but you can actually back out from a bond price the likelihood of default. So what you're trying to do here is essentially you're doing a decision tree. You're valuing the company with the DCF for the going concern. You're saying there's a chance my company will not make it. You're estimating what your equity will be worth under that scenario, and you're taking an expected value. So you ready? Let's try this. This is a valuation I did of a casino company called Las Vegas Sands. Now, casino companies are notoriously over-levered, and they tend to be run by megalomaniacs. And I'm not kidding. You look at Wynn Resorts, Steve Wynn. Las Vegas Sands is run by a guy called Sheldon Adelson. The guy built the company up from nothing. And in the last decade, 2000 through 2007, they're one of the fastest growing casino companies in the world. They were building new casinos in Macau. They actually, if you've ever been in Singapore, it's Marina Bay Sands, it's the Las Vegas Sands. So they were building casinos all over the world. And they were borrowing money to do it. Why? Because Sheldon Adelson owned 52% of the shares and didn't want to issue any new shares because he'd give up control. So he's building these huge casinos. Each was costing $500 million to $1 billion, borrowing money to do it. And when the times were good, people looked the other way. They had a lot of debt, but they said, oh, that's okay. They're a growing, successful casino company. Then 2008, just like the coronavirus, massive market crisis. And all of a sudden, people walk up and say, oh my God, Las Vegas Sands has lots of debt. So this is the valuation I was doing with Las Vegas Sands in February 2009. This is the heart of the crisis. And I'll tell you, as I was sitting down to value Las Vegas Sands, I was reading news stories about how Las Vegas Sands would not make it through the next 6 months when the next debt payment was due. I closed off my mind to all those bad news stories. I put my optimist hat on. And I'll explain what I mean by my optimist hat. Basically, I valued Las Vegas Sands as if it would make it back to health and be a successful company. So I said, look, I'll be an optimist, let's do it. And I fixed it. And I fixed it at least in my spreadsheet. How did I fix it? Well, this is a company that's a money-losing company with a lot of debt, right? How do you make a money-losing company with a lot of debt into a healthy company into a spreadsheet? Easy. I let revenues grow over time as the people who left casinos came back. I let margins improve back to what they'd been historically. So my losses became profits. And as I did that, I also paid down debt to bring my debt ratio down to what I thought was a reasonable level. It's so easy to fix distressed companies on a spreadsheet. So this is not an unrealistic valuation, but it's a valuation of what would have to happen for Las Vegas Sands to become a healthy company. And based on my assumptions, the value per share that I got for Las Vegas Sands, if it makes it back to health, was $8.12. The stock was trading at $4.25. Now, the question you need to ask is, hey, you know what? And the NOL carry forwards eventually help you on taxes, but that's a small part of the story. The tax rate goes up over time because as your NOL gets paid off, initially you have no taxes, but as the NOL gets paid off, your tax rates increase. Eventually you hit a steady state tax rate. So I finished the $8.12, stock trading at $4.25. I actually did this presentation in 2009. And somebody asked, would you buy Las Vegas Sands? Your value is $8.12, the stock is $4.25. And I said, no. And I had to go through some soul searching. Because if I have faith in value and my value is 812 and the stock is trading at 425, shouldn't I be loading up on the stock? You know what is holding me back? All those stories about Las Vegas Sands not making it. And here's why it is holding me back. $8.12 is the value for Las Vegas Sands if it survives and becomes a healthy company again, right? But there's a chance it won't make it and my value doesn't reflect it. You're saying, can't I increase my cost of debt? It really is not. Look at my cost of capital. It's not that sensitive to how distressed I am. A discounted cash flow valuation, the discount rate is a blunt instrument. It's not designed to carry things like, what if my company doesn't make? So I had to bring that in explicitly after I finished my DCF. And here's how I did. I went to the bond market and I looked at the rating for Las Vegas Sands. It was rated B+. Now, if I wanted to, I could have used the B+ rating and the probability of default I would get based on the B+ rating is historically that number would have been about 28.25%. I could have used that. And if I were in a hurry, that's what I'd have done. There's a 28.25% chance Las Vegas Sands will not make it and you know, a 71% chance it will. But Las Vegas Sands had bonds outstanding. And I'm going to show you how you can use a bond price to back out the probability that your company will not make it. It was a 7-year bond with a $63.75 coupon for the next 7 years. So basically what you have here are my promised coupons and my promised face value. 6.375% coupon rate is the $63.75 and the 1,000 is the face value of the bond. It's a 7-year bond. Now, normally the way we price bonds is we take the promised coupons and discount them back at a risk-adjusted discount. That's not what I'm going to do here. Here's what I did instead. I took the expected coupons. You say, what the heck is an expected coupon? Remember, to get the promised coupon, my company is going to be has to be around. So I multiplied each promised coupon by the probability that my company will be around. You say, I don't know that yet. You're right. It's an unknown. Let's leave it as an unknown. And because I'm adjusting my coupons and face value for the risk, I can discount these cash flows back at a risk-free rate. So I have the price of the bond, I have the promised coupons, I have a risk-free rate. All I don't know is the probability that my company will not make it, right? In my Excel spreadsheet, I solved for it. I came up with 13.5% per year. You see, what does that even mean? For the bond to be priced at 529, there's got to be a 13.5% chance of failure every year. And if you think about my discounted cash flow valuation, my big value happens in year 10 to get to my terminal value. If I believe this probability of default, there's a 23% chance that my company will make it through to year 10 in Nirvana. There's a 77% chance, to the degree that I trust the bond market, that my company will not make it. So here's what I have. There's a 23% chance that Las Vegas Sands will make it, and my value per share, that 23% chance, is $8.12, my DCF value. The remaining 77% of the time, the company will not be able to make its debt payments. It'll have to liquidate itself. And guess what? They're going to get, if they try to sell all these casinos around, but they're not going to be able to cover their debt value, which means my equity value is going to be zero. My expected value for Las Vegas Sands is $8.12 times the 23% chance they will make it, plus zero times the 77% chance that they will. Next week, your valuation of the week is going to be Boeing. And I want to value Boeing because it's in the heart of the storm right now, right? I'm going to do a DCF value for Boeing, and I'm going to come up with a value. But then I'm going to complete the process by asking, what is the chance that Boeing will not make it, or the equity in Boeing will not make it? Because if you have a bailout and my equity gets wiped out, that's the same thing as my equity not making. The only way I can complete my valuation of Boeing is to bring in that probability. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how I'll estimate that for Boeing. But remember this example, because this is the example where I learned how to do it, to attach that property. Because if I hadn't done that, there would have been a lot of companies that look cheap. Now, the way you get the property is you have to use the solver function in Excel. So basically enter the price, the cash flows, and use the solver function in Excel. There's no way you can mathematically solve for it. So you'd have to use the solver function in Excel. So Austin had a question of where do I get the 13.54%? You basically have to enter the price, the present value equation, and then hit the solver function for the only unknown here, which is the probability of failure. Okay. So it's a little messy if you're doing it by hand, but with Excel, it's very, very doable. So any questions about distressed companies? Because some of you, as I said, will be dealing with companies where attaching this post-DCF estimate to failure is going to make the difference on whether you find this company to be undervalued or not.
Professor, I have a question.
Yep.
So the 76.66% probability is has a time horizon of 10 years, right? So let's say the company goes bankrupt in year 10. You will still be able to get the next 9 years of cash flow?
It is a shortcut. So maybe the question you're asking is, shouldn't I be estimating a probability of default in year one? In a perfect world, that's what I would do, right? Because you can use a one-year bond to estimate a one-year default. Because many of these firms, what you actually have is the probability of default for these firms is going to be highest in year one. Do you see why? Because the virus has created a crisis, and the crisis means that if you can make it through year one, you're going to be okay. So the 77% really is, it's 55% in year one, and then very quickly drops off as you get to the future years. So you know, to the extent that this failure risk is imminent, it's not worth breaking it out by year. Do you see what I'm saying? If you think the failure risk is spread out over time, then I think it makes sense to do year specific numbers. But usually when you do this, it's because you're worried about next year, not what happens in year 8 or 9 or 10.
I see. Thank you.
Okay. Well, the distressed sale proceeds, I just took the real estate value of the casinos and I took 50% of that value because there'd been a few casinos that had actually gone under in 2009. And you looked at what they got in it. I mean, how many potential buyers can you have for a casino? Can you imagine trying to sell, Caesar's Tahoe or Caesar's Vegas? I mean, there are like three people who can buy it, and they're all in trouble with you. So when you try to sell something in a hurry, especially in a business with assets this monstrous, you're going to give up a lot. So it's basically half of the real estate value of the casinos at the time that I did this valuation for the $27.69. Any other questions?
I have one question.
Go ahead.
So there's a lot of talk in the media about the possible bailout package by the government.
Yeah.
So let's say you're an airline company. Well, how should you price?
First, you need to check the specifics of the bailout, right? Because we don't know the terms of the bailout yet. Just the fact that cash is coming to an airline doesn't mean your equity is saved. Because remember, GM got a bailout package in 2009 from the federal government. It allowed GM to survive as a company. But in return for the bailout, you know what the government required of GM? It actually had to take the existing equity and wipe out the equity. So the equity investors in GM were wiped out by the bailout. And even though GM made it back as a company, it survived as a company, the equity was worth nothing, the original equity. So until we know the specifics of the bailout package, I think we're jumping the gun. So because these bailouts are going to come with restrictions, so far it doesn't look like the U.S. government is going to require, because Boeing actually yesterday preempted the bailout. If you read the news story yesterday, The Boeing CEO said, if in return for the bailout, the US government wants our equity, we don't want the bailout. So Boeing actually has been explicit that they don't want a bailout, but their equity gets wiped out. But some of the more desperate airlines might have no choice. They might have to take the bailout. But you'll have to look at what the quid pro is. In return for the bailout, what will you be giving up as equity investors? Because until you know that, it's going to be difficult for you to value the equity as a result of the bailout. But we'll know that as the law gets passed, we'll know the explicit quid pro.
Makes sense. Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay. Now let's talk about valuing emerging market companies and at least set up the process as what makes emerging market companies potentially difficult. Again, we ask the question, what are your cash flows? What's the value added from growth? How risky are you? With emerging market companies, I'll tell you the biggest problem. There's always a macro problem hanging in the background. Let me explain. When you value a Brazilian company, you can ask, what are your cash flows? What's the value of growth? How risky are you? And when will you become a mature company? Look at the company. But let's face it, what Brazil does as a country affects every one of these, right? So when Brazil had those corruption problems in 2016 or 17, guess what? Even the best run Brazilian companies, Natura Cosmetics, for instance, a company I really like, I think it's well run, the cash flows were affected, the value from growth was affected, the risk was affected. So with emerging market companies, there is always this country risk issue in the background. And one of the nice things about doing this late in the class is we've already talked about country risk. And with country risk, you got to use a scalpel. In other words, when you have a Brazilian company, you can't just take the Brazilian country risk and hit it. You have to think about where the company gets its revenue. So if you're Embraer, you're less exposed to Brazilian country risk than if you're Ambev. So one of the reasons I went through country risk in so much detail was because I knew this was coming. Many of you are going to be valuing companies with emerging market exposures, and I want you to wear the scalpel rather than a carving knife when you think about country risk. But country risk has to be incorporated, but it has to be incorporated carefully. Not all emerging market companies are equally exposed to country risk. So I'll leave you with this final valuation, and we'll come back and kind of flesh it out. This is a valuation of Embraer I did a long time ago, 2000. I actually bought Embraer after I did this valuation. But the valuation in nominal, it was actually a valuation done when Brazil was going through one of its periodic country risk spasms. So, of course, Embraer is an aerospace company, and it's a Brazilian company. The way I brought in country risk is by bringing in the Lambda. In fact, this is a calculation I went through earlier in the class when I talked about Lambda. This is the cost of capital calculation. So this is what I mean by a scalpel. Embraer is a Brazilian company, but I'm not punishing it with the entire Brazilian country risk because I don't think it's as exposed to Brazilian country risk as the typical Brazilian company. So by either using the weighted average equity risk premium or by using Lambda, that's exactly what you're doing. You're wielding a scalpel rather than a carving knife. So with Embraer, the key number is there is country risk, but not as much country risk as investors were building into the valuation. One reason I ended up buying Embraer after this valuation was because investors were punishing Embraer like every other Brazilian company. So as you look at this valuation, the only real number that's different from my previous valuation, the 3M valuation, is the country risk number. But the country risk effect on Embraer is far lower than in a typical Brazilian company because of where it gets its revenues. One final point, as you look at the airlines, I know the airlines are getting punished because the travel business is shut down. But do you think people are using a scalpel when they go through? Are they punishing the good airline companies and the bad ones, the high level? I think they're actually punishing every airline. So one of the things you might want to look at if you're looking through the rubble is those airline companies that are different from the norm, Southwest Airlines, Ryanair, because it is a lot less debt than a typical European airline. Maybe Singapore Air, it's on a more robust foundation than most other international airlines. So the same approach that allowed me to find Embraer to be cheap in 2004 might be an approach that allows you to find an airline that is cheap today, given how much punishment has been meted out in that sector. So I'm going to leave with that final point, but when we come back, I'm going to continue on our discussion of emerging market company valuations. but it'll be the day of the quiz. So actually, I'm going to make the quiz end before the class begins, so people are not leaving the class to get to the quiz. So there'll be an 8 or 9 hour window before the quiz in New York time. So I think I've set it for 6 a.m. New York time to 3 p.m. New York time. Anytime during that period, you can come in and take the quiz. And so you should be done by 3 o'clock, and by 3:30 you should be ready for the next class, and we'll continue our discussion evaluation. So before I leave, any final questions? None? Go ahead, Rodrigo. Oh, you had a question or no?
No.
Okay, so because I saw your mic come in.
Wait, I have a question.
Yep.
So we're logging on at 3:30, taking this for an hour.
No. You're not logging on at 3:30. It's going to be open for 9 hours that day. You can log on anytime you want during that 9 hour period. The reason I had to do that is 3:30 is going to be, because there are about 30 people in Shanghai from this class.
Right.
3:30 is going to be 3:30 in the morning for them. So basically, I'm leaving a 9 hour window. You can open the quiz anytime during that 9 hour window. You will have a full class period. Or maybe that day I'll go easy on the class. Maybe I'll do only a 45 minute session. But okay. I couldn't figure out a way to do it with the class, because then everybody would have to take it at the time of the class, and that would be a nightmare.
Right.
So I would set enough time that day that you have a window of 1 hour during that day to come in and take the quiz, but it won't be during class time specifically. It'll be during that day, a 9 hour window.
Okay.
And 1 hour during that 9 hours, you can come in and take it.
All right.
Professor? Hello, did I answer your question?
Yeah. Professor?
Yep.
I read your blog post, I think it was on February 23rd, and it was about like the viral market one.
Which one? Second one? So that was the second one, I think, right? Very first one?
The one, basically, you said it was you could be underestimating the effects of it, and I kind of wanted to just know, it's been a while since.
You should read the next three. You've stopped after viral update one. There have been three more.
I haven't read, all right, my bad.
Yeah, so go ahead and read the other three. You kind of get a sense of where I am now. And there'll be another one, I think, on Monday, which hopefully will be my last viral update, and we can move on to a regular world, a post-virus world.
Amazing. Thank you.
Well, somebody asked a format for the question. It'll be multiple choice. It'll be online. It's actually a very easy platform to work with, and you can go back and forth across the questions, and you can use your laptop.
Professor?
Yes.
For the exams, since your class doesn't have NYU classes, will you send us a link of where we're going to do the exam, or will it be
in your class? It's on NYU classes. So basically, you have to go to NYU classes, click on tests and quizzes. So go to NYU classes, and on the left, when you go to NYU classes, there's tests and quizzes. I'll send you the explicit instructions. But if you've never been on NYU classes, get there this week so you get comfortable with the format, so you're not looking for it on Monday. So get on NYU classes, and on the left, you'll see a list of menu items, and one says tests and quizzes. You click on tests and quizzes, you'll see quiz two. You click on it, and the minute you click on it, you have an hour. So be careful that you don't click on it until you're ready to take the quiz. What slides does the quiz cover? Everything to the end of loose ends, which was what, 40 slides ago? So basically, it's through the employee compensation, stock-based compensation. So I don't know what page was that, 250-something.
Professor, I have a question regarding something we did in the past in another class. It's regarding the expected growth in EBIT and fundamentals if you have a stable ROC and a reinvestment rate. When you use the change in working capital, is it a non-cash changing?
It's always
capital,
non-cash.
Or is it?
It's always non-cash. Always non-cash working capital.
Okay, perfect. Okay, great. Thank you.
Professor, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Do you think the markets have overreacted in the last couple of days with the bailout package news, with the $4 trillion?
One of the things I said in my last post was, this is a pricing market. And trying to explain on a day-to-day basis why markets are doing what they're doing is not just an exercise in frustration. It's not worth it. Just markets will shoot up, markets shoot down. Did they overreact yesterday, the day before? Probably. Did they overreact last week when they went down 2,000 points? Probably. Overreaction is the name of the game in pricing. So it's the answer is probably yes to every single day's movement. They're probably overreacting. Why are they overreacting? Because people are terrified. They have no idea what's coming. So don't do anything rash based on that, right? Don't sell short on the market. Don't go long on the market. Don't react to whatever happened yesterday. And that's why I want to get back to basics. That's the only way you can get some sanity in a market like this one. Rafael has a question about you submit the projects as a group. You're already thinking about the project, Rafael? I'm impressed. I mean, that's not till May 11th. You know, I gave people the choice. Remember that email? I said, if you can work as a group, I'd prefer it. Now, so if you can work as a group and submit the project as a group, I'd like that. But to the extent that's going to be difficult for you to do, then I'm okay with you doing your valuation individually and turning in just an individual valuation.
Professor, this is a quick one. Is 125% reinvestment rate extreme, or is that a possible?
It's a what percent reinvestment rate?
125%.
Well, it depends on the company, right? If you're a high growth company where you have 50% growth in year one, 125% reinvestment rate might be too low. So unless you tell me what company you're talking about and what growth rate you have, so it can't be a low or high. There's no norm in this. It depends on where you are in the life cycle and how quickly you have to grow.
I see.
Oh, the question is about the DCF. I got it wrong. Rafael's question about was about the feedback thing. The feedback, just do individually. Don't do it as a group. Just submit it individually. So this is the April 3rd where I give you a one-time deal where you can turn in your DCF and I take a quick look at it. That do individually, don't do it as a group. But remember to put that my perfect valuation, DCF valuation in the subject. Otherwise I'm getting so many emails every day, it's gonna get lost. So I'll send you a reminder again. But that, so I'm glad Sama brought that up. This is for the final project report, do it as a group. But for the feedback, just do it individually. Any other questions?
I have a question about the project as well.
Do we
abide by the four, like one international company, one high growth, if we're going to change so much?
Well, didn't you already pick it? Are you telling me you didn't pick a company already? You're still thinking about
it? No. I already have a company. I'm just saying, like, because our group.
Oh, the group, no, that's fine. Because the person who's doing the international company disbands and does it on their own, you can't really meet. No, don't worry about the criteria. You're okay.
All right, thank you.
Okay, folks, I'm going to wrap up, and I will see you next Monday, hopefully after the quiz, and you'll all be happy because the quiz was so easy, but that's what I'm hoping. And I'll see you soon. Take care.